From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1880. Susan B. Anthony wrote a letter to Rachel Foster Avery, a 22-year-old woman who was active in the women's rights and suffrage movement. That letter is part of a trove of nearly 100 letters recently obtained by the University of Rochester. Now, in 1883, Rachel would travel through Europe with Susan B. Anthony. She later held the office of corresponding secretary of the National Women's Suffrage Association and of the National and the International Council of Women. So what can we learn from these nearly 100 letters? What do they say? What do they tell us about the suffrage movement and the 19th Amendment that is now 94 years old? We're going to have fun going back in time and learning what we can from these letters with our guests for the hour. Our panel includes Jim Kuhn, the Joseph N. Lambert and Harold B. Schleifer, Director of Rare Books, Special Collections, and Preservation at the River Campus Libraries at the University of Rochester. Jim, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. I'm pleased to join you this morning.
Lori Burrell is the Historical Manuscript Librarian for Rare Books, Special Collections, and Preservations at the University of Rochester's River Campus Libraries. Lori, nice to see you.
Great to be here.
On the phone with us, we have Dr. Catherine Cerulli, the Director of the Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership. Dr. Cerulli, thank you for joining us.
Very much.
Let me just start with some of the basics here in terms of the acquisition of these letters. Again, Jim and Lori, nearly 100 letters is what we know. Is that about right?
That's about right, including some additional correspondence from the Rachel Foster Avery to other members of her family and some signed photographs and other family paper material.
Okay, so 1880 to December 24th, 1880 is the first one, through roughly the turn of the century. So almost 20 years of correspondence. Susan B. Anthony is a name that obviously everyone knows, but Rachel Foster Avery maybe not. And we're going to be talking about her and what these letters tell us. But first, I have to just know about the acquisition process. The process started, Jim, you were saying it started back in April for the University of Rochester?
Yes, it did. And in fact, we had a descendant of the Avery family reach out to the Susan B. Anthony house here in Rochester. And a docent at the house, Mary Huth, who is a former assistant librarian in the Rare Books and Special Collections Department, reached out to us about this. This descendant of the family is somehow related, and we're not sure exactly how, mm-hmm. to another descendant of Avery's, who in 1972 sold some other correspondence from Susan B. Anthony to Rachel at auction, and we purchased those papers in 1972. So what we've acquired this summer joins a collection which it sort of reunites a collection that once was entirely in the hands of Rachel Foster Avery, but at some point had been split up among descendants.
Okay, and so, and let me ask, you know, Lori, when you hear, first of all, about these, you get contacted, you hear about this trove of materials, but you have to verify authenticity, and there's a process for that. Take me through kind of some of the steps, and Jim, you can both kind of touch on some of the steps that are involved in making sure you have what you think you have and how that kind of worked. Jim?
Well, so a couple things. One, we had some Mary, in fact, went on a side trip from a vacation she was taking to Ann Arbor, drove out, had a look at the letters, said, you know what, they're the real deal. We reached out then to an appraiser. We wanted an independent assessment, and that appraiser helped us by compiling lists of each letters and confirming the contents and confirming that, yes, in fact, these are letters from Susan B. Anthony to Rachel Foster Avery. The auction house did their own catalog and reproduced many of the letters, and so we had that as well. But through this process of obviously being very interested, but, you know, wanting to confirm, trust but verify, we confirmed that indeed these really were what they were purported to be,
yeah.
and things that we really needed to acquire, if at all possible.
Now, what happens to the paper material over time? I mean, there has to be a breakdown, and hopefully, I imagine if they're still legible, these were preserved pretty well, but can they break down over time, and what's the concern there?
Some of the paper in the collection is a little more brittle, but most of the letters that we just acquired are in really remarkable shape. When you hold it in your hand, it's very sturdy. You can still read the ink. Susan B. Anthony liked to cross out a lot. She liked to sort of get her words exactly right on the page, which is really exciting to read. But by and large, the letters are in really great shape.
And coming up here, we're going to hopefully hear some of the, at least the chunks of these correspondence. But let me ask Dr. Cerulli, when you hear about you know, 90 to 100 letters that we didn't know about before. How significant is that a find in your mind? What's the immediate significance that comes to mind for you?
Oh, it's so exciting. We had just met with the folks at the library a couple of days ago. The Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester has been reading letters written by Susan B. Anthony in various collections and examining them for things related to what Susan B. Anthony would say to contemporary women today. And those are things about friendship, death, dying, child rearing, sort of a side to Susan that we don't see very often. And clearly these letters with Miss Avery are going to be able to raise the dialogue that we've started. We've reviewed hundreds of letters, and this is an incredibly rich and exciting collection for us to now be able to look at, to examine really how a modern-day Susan B. Anthony might be talking to us as women today.
Dr. Cerulli, Susan B. Anthony would have been, at the start of these letters that were discovered, she would have been around maybe around 60. Do I have the timeline right?
I missed the date that Jim just shared.
1880 is when the first letter that was found. And Susan B. Anthony was born in 1820, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so she would have been around 60 years old with a 22-year-old recipient of these letters. And what sort of came to mind for me, even before reading some of these and hearing about some of them, Dr. Cerulli, is that Susan B. Anthony was kind of constantly interested in making sure younger generations were part of this movement and this effort. And she knew that it was vital that it continue to build. You know, some people can kind of get so tied up in their own efforts, and she was very outgoing, I think it seemed, at least, with next generations on some of these efforts, wasn't she?
Oh, yes, and one of the things when we were reading the letters between her and Avery, and she also mentions Avery in several of her letters to other women, really talking about this younger generation taking the movement and going on, and also respecting that they may be going on in different ways. And recognizing that they have their own, you know, burdens to bear. She also did an amazing job in mentoring these younger women and giving them positions of leadership and in many ways trusting them.
Let's talk a little bit more about who the recipient was, because again, as I mentioned, if you're just joining us, Susan B. Anthony is a name you know. Rachel Foster Avery, a lot of people, I would say most, don't. And what's her place in history now, Dr. Cerulli? Rachel Foster Avery.
Well, as you mentioned, she was with the National Council for Women, and she really carried on much of the work of the movement for women. And Lori, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. So she's also credited with revitalizing the Pennsylvania Woman Suffrage Association around the turn of the century. And although Avery didn't live to see the ratification of the 19th Amendment, she died a few months earlier, she really is part of that last and ultimately successful push for suffrage.
If our listeners, if you have any questions about not only the process here of uncovering history this way, we'd love to hear your questions on that. You can join the conversation. We're having it right now online at Evan Dawson on Twitter, or you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. But I think there are broader issues that we'll get to as we go throughout the hour. Because I think this week is an appropriate one to look at women's suffrage, equality, and other issues related to it. And, you know, we're talking about 94 years since the 19th Amendment. So these letters, really, really remarkable to kind of get a glimpse into what some of those conversations were like in the years, the few decades leading up to that. So, Jim, can you share some examples of some of what the letters uncovered?
Sure. So this is a working relationship between someone who was described as one of her favorite lieutenants, one of her favorite nieces, a working relationship between Susan B. Anthony and Rachel Foster Avery, who were actively strategizing about the political work that they had to do. But these letters show a really remarkable personal side to the relationship as well. Many of them are signed lovingly yours. Many of them are signed affectionately yours. Susan B. Anthony signed some of them from Aunt Susan. We have a letter, I'm sorry, a photograph of Rachel Foster Avery that she gave to Susan B. Anthony here in Rochester on a visit, and it's inscribed to her second mother. So this is a relationship that was very strong and operated on many levels. And so some of the content of the letters reveals the very many ways in which they related to each other. Laurie, do you want to share a quote or two?
Sure. So when Rachel Foster Avery was pregnant in 1890 with her first, the first child she would give birth to, Anthony writes her what I think is just a really beautiful and heartwarming letter. And she is really encouraging Avery to take it easy, which if you read other letters by Anthony, this is sort of an unusual tact for her to take because she's always encouraging Avery to get more involved and she wishes that Avery could be with her and be a more integrated part of the movement, although Avery certainly was. And she writes, "With all of your own strengths and philosophy, you ought not to use them up so absolutely as to have none left to the little life that is growing within you. So I beg you, don't try to keep nerved up to your highest possible tension, but just relax the muscles of your mind as well as body from this on." And some of the words in the letter are underlined. The word mind is underlined. And certainly Anthony's mind was always active, and she was encouraging women like Avery to be have that kind of level of engagement. So this letter is just a really special one.
And let me ask Dr. Cerulli, when they talk about how personal those letters were in terms of Susan B. Anthony, the way she signed the letters and the way she referred to herself and the way she addressed Rachel Foster Avery, in terms of context, was that rare or common for the way Susan B. Anthony communicated with others?
In the letters we've been reading, it was actually quite common. And there was a beautiful piece, which I'd be happy to read if time allows, where she talks about something that Rachel did for her, which was touching, and she describes that in a letter to Elizabeth Smith Miller. And when she talks about Rachel in that letter, she starts out with, "I must tell you of the dearest, latest act of my darling Rachel Foster Avery." And it's almost motherly in tone. I mean, when you think about that word, darling, and she uses very expressive language in her letters that she writes.
Yeah, we're game for hearing any examples you want to share. If you want to, Dr. Cerulli, I would love to hear more.
I'll just read a very small section of a letter dated March 21st, 1899, where she writes to Elizabeth Smith Miller. She's describing an act of kindness and generosity on the part of Rachel. Quote, "Oh, I must tell you of the dearest, latest act of my darling Rachel Foster Avery. On learning that my dressmaker had signified that she would like to trim my new black plain satin dress with point lace, Rachel went at once to her safety deposit bank and took out some of the loveliest black and white point lace that were her sainted mothers and sisters and expressed to me to choose them. So she wishes me to leave in my will that they are to go to her youngest little girl, Julie." I mean, that is just that a piece of lace would be so meaningful to her and that Rachel gave it to her when it was made by her own family.
Are there parts of the letters, and again, if you're just joining us, nearly 90 to 100 letters from Susan B. Anthony, letters to Rachel Foster Avery, a younger woman active in the women's rights and suffrage movement. Are there any parts of the letters that stand out? We've been talking about the personal side that we might not know too much about. Are there parts of the letters that talked more about some of the substance of the movement, the efforts of the time, et cetera? Obviously, there was so much happening, and it was impossible to know at the time that Susan B. Anthony and Rachel Foster Avery would die before suffrage happened. But were there parts of the letters that give us an insight into how things were going at the time?
Absolutely. There's a great letter from September 4th, 1889, and this is a really key time in the movement. This is right before two of the major women's suffrage organizations merge, and they would merge the following year. And Anthony writes to Avery about what's going on in terms of this great merger, and there was a lot of component parts to it. And she writes, "Mrs. Stanton feels very strongly that we should do more to drop both the national and American now that there is but one society, and that it should be Woman Suffrage Association of the United States. but I am told that there is plenty of time to consider that, as it would have to be recommended in 1890 and acted upon in 1891. And so from this letter, we can see what Anthony's ideas were for this new joined organization, and that previous names for the suffrage organizations should sort of be shed aside in favor of moving forward as one. And there are a number of letters in this new acquisition that talk about this very complicated process.
It's amazing hearing a letter from 1890, you said?
1889.
That, you know, you look back at the movement and they're strategizing on how to name something and how to approach something. And it frankly is embarrassing for this country when you look back and read that this was even necessary at the time and that we were still 30 years away, 30 plus years away at the time. But I guess, Dr. Cerulli, these kind of letters are vital for us to see some of the strategizing, some of the hard work that was going on day to day, year to year, just to move that rock up the hill, I guess.
Right, and that they were really indefatigable. I mean, they just never stopped. And when one tours the house, the museum here in town, I just brought a group through, a colleague actually, and I had a team building exercise, and the young women on the team wanted to visit the house as their team building exercise, which to me shows you how relevant this work is today. But in a description of Rachel Foster Avery in the movement, Susan B. says, "What she has been to me personally during all this time, I cannot put into words. When, as a young girl, she accompanied me on a trip abroad 18 years ago, she was my eyes, my ears, my tongue, and during the long period which has since intervened, she has been my right hand." I mean, every movement needs multiple ambassadors. And, you know, these letters really show the breadth and depth of women's contributions to the right to vote and how many different women were involved. And what is incredible is as popular as Susan B. Anthony was and as she was in the front lines of the movement, she never ceases to give credit to the people who helped her and the way that they helped her.
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership. We also have Jim Kuhn and Lori Burrell in studio. They are with the Rare Book Special Collections and Preservation at the River Campus Libraries at the University of Rochester, now in possession of nearly 100 letters written from Susan B. Anthony from 1880 to around the turn of the century in 1900 to a woman named Rachel Foster Avery. And we're getting insight into their some of the personal touches to the struggles of suffrage and the women's rights movements, and also some of the strategizing that was going on. Really remarkable stuff. I should have addressed this earlier, but on Twitter, Alexis wants to know, where can we see the letters? I apologize for burying the lead there. Jim, do you want to let our listeners know if they can see the letters?
Sure. So the letters are now in the possession of the River Campus Libraries, and we're working on cataloging them. There's a preliminary list is online under the Anthony Avery Collection, and we plan to digitize them in the coming weeks and months. That will require taking digital photographs of each page, but we also have plans to transcribe the letters. A digital photograph of a manuscript letter isn't keyword searchable.
Right.
For that, you need a written transcript. And this is a process that we engage in actively at River Campus Libraries using students, working in classes, using student employees, using graduate students and volunteers, but also in particular using grant funding and using fundraising is an important component to getting the large manuscript collections that currently exist digitized and transcribed and placed online.
And Jim had mentioned that you obtained these letters via auction, and even if you can't put the exact number on it, can you give us a sense for, you know, was this a normal auction price? Actually, you can decline to answer. I'll just ask you, what did you have to pay for it?
So it's a good question, and it's one reason why we wanted to reach out to an independent appraiser to sort of get a third party, an expert opinion on what they might be worth. This was a tricky situation because the auction that we're talking about was planning to break the collection into lots and sell each letter individually. We successfully negotiated with the auction house and through them with the family to sell this collection as a whole so that it did not go up to be separately bid on one letter at a time. Keeping a collection like this together is really important to enhancing the value and the meaning of each individual object. We spent about 80% of our endowed funds, relevant endowed funds for the year, in August, which is the second month of the fiscal year. So we burned through a lot of our available funds for this purchase, but it was fairly non-controversial, I have to say. In fact, it was non-controversial. I mean, this is a purchase that we just had to go for, attempt to make. And now we're fundraising.
And here you are. And now you're fundraising. So Jim and Laurie, how do you break down the work here in terms of there are a lot of questions I have about the process, because you have to, first of all, read the letters. How good is her handwriting? We've talked about the Seward House, William Henry Seward, his letters. His handwriting was pretty awful. And I know the University of Rochester has plenty of old Seward letters. I would not want to have the job of transcribing those. How about Susan B. Anthony? How's her handwriting?
I would say that her handwriting kind of depends based on her level of excitement, or what I imagine to be how hurried she was. Uh-huh. So with some of the letters that we've read from this afternoon, there's a little bit of guesswork involved, and it's really wonderful to have the opportunity to do that kind of guesswork. So she likes to underline her letters a lot. She likes to put exclamation points. There's a letter where she's talking about how they just put a phone in at the house and how her sister Mary is really excited about it and making calls on it. And at the end of that sentence, there are two great exclamation points. And when you see photographs of Susan B. Anthony, and sometimes when you read some of her words, the words just don't jump off the page. We need a little help to understand the context, and those types of punctuation are just great ways to get at it.
Yeah, you also mentioned occasionally she would cross out, kind of self-edit as she went there. Is that right?
Yep, and sometimes it's just she's repeated a word, and as she goes back to read it, I would imagine she realized that she had repeated the word, so she'll cross it out. And other times you can just see that she really wants to be careful with what she says. She puts a lot of meaning into her words, a lot of thought, it appears, and so getting it right was important.
Dr. Cerulli, when you see the letters, I think Laurie makes such an interesting point that it's one thing if you heard them read to you. It's another to see the way that they are written. What goes through your mind when you look at the actual handwriting on the page?
Well, actually, there's a little bit of a personal story here. When I first started reading them, and Laurie was very gracious in helping me walk through this process, I took on the project of reading Susan B. Anthony's letters when I took over the directorship of the center. And the reason I did is because while I had been working in women's issues for about 30 years, I was by no means a scholar of Susan B. Anthony. And I wanted to get to know who she was. And I had read books, I had gone to lectures, I had heard movies, and I thought there's no better way to begin to know who she is than by reading her letters and having a firsthand account of who she is. And I really wasn't prepared for the emotional experience of sitting in the library at U of R and having the first packet handed to me, opening the manila folder and having those papers there that she had touched, she had written, and as Laurie said, she had given great thought to. It was a very emotional experience for me. And when I started to read the letters, it was almost as though she was sitting at the table with me speaking to me. And Laurie was incredible with being able to help with a missing word here or there. We would ask Laurie for an interpretation. But as you begin to read the letters and understand the context of them, you start to almost become familiar with her word pattern. And she writes in often old cursive, which we're not being schooled anymore in old cursive. So I have some concerns about history moving forward, that these letters get digitized and transcribed quickly, because I know many young people, including high schoolers, who can't read cursive even today. So I think that there's a real urgency to reading these letters. I also want to let the callers know, in addition to U of R's amazing collection, there are other libraries that have digital access to some of Susan B. Anthony's letters. And, you know, as we commented earlier, it's sometimes difficult to see a photo image of them. But if people are interested in reading them for the sake of getting to see her handwriting, I think there's nothing like the in-person experience. We just read some, a couple hundred letters at the library in New York City. And again, that experience of sitting in a library archive and smelling the paper and feeling the paper is quite remarkable.
Yeah, always an amazing, sort of a transporting experience. Jim and Lori, when it comes to the dynamics of language, I learned an interesting lesson a few years back when I found a diary that my father had written in the 1960s. He traveled to Europe with a couple of college classmates. They spent the entire summer there. They purchased a raggedy car, drove it around Europe, and they went to seven or eight different countries. And he wrote a nightly diary no matter where they were, no matter sober or not, wherever he was. My father was absolutely religious about keeping a diary. And so as a surprise gift for him, I transcribed the whole thing, and we kind of brought it back to life, and then we kind of traced his route, and we looked up where they had gone. The hardest part for me, oddly, of that, and this is the 1960s, not the 1880s, 90s, et cetera, was that there were certain turns of phrase that I was not familiar with. And I had to do a little digging to find out. So we actually made, for fun, we made a little glossary at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know now, when you look back at the way Susan B. Anthony wrote to Rachel Foster Avery, do you have to sort of familiarize yourself with different turns of phrase or dynamics of language that are very different today? Lori, give me a sense for that.
I think so. When we work with students to transcribe Anthony, as well as other collections, I'm always amazed that students really struggle sometimes with those turns of phrases or the abbreviations. And we talk about their abbreviations and will anyone know, you know, what BRB means, you know, 10 years from now. And then I always say, I don't even know if you're still using that, but that's what I used to use. But Anthony abbreviates all the time. She was a busy lady. And so she writes MTG for meeting, or she writes COVT or COVN for convention. Or, you know, she'll abbreviate the name of an association because she knows that Rachel Foster Avery is in lockstep and knows exactly what she's talking about. And so it's really interesting, as Dr. Cerulli was saying, you really have to get into the language. You have to get into the letters to start to understand that context and to begin to, you know, play a bit of a detective to understand.
Are there times where you've felt legitimately tripped up, Jim or Lori?
Oh, definitely. Anthony's handwriting is challenging, and sometimes it's just hard to understand what she's trying to say. I came across a word earlier, and I couldn't figure out if she was talking about singing something or signing something, and I'm still not 100% sure, but I'll keep at it.
What about you, Jim?
Yeah, there's a phrase that appears in one of these letters, which is a Dutch hunt, which appears to refer to looking for something that they can't find. And I would have thought that this would have been a slang term that you could easily throw some quotes around and type into Google and add the word slang and find. The only other hit that I found was in the Internet Archive in a biography of Lincoln.
So you thought you'd find an easy answer.
I did.
but no soap, to borrow a phrase from the 60s that I had to relearn. Yep. No soap meant no dice, no luck. How interesting to look at the way language has changed. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back. And I want to hear from Dr. Cerulli about, we had a conversation last week on this program about the meanings of modern feminism. And I'm curious to know, I mean, no one speaks for Susan B. Anthony, but I'm curious to know if there are insights into what we might learn from not only these letters, but the woman who was Susan B. Anthony and what she might say about modern feminist movement. So let's take a short break and come right back more on this fascinating conversation about these letters uncovered now in possession at the University of Rochester. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined in studio by Jim Kuhn and Lori Burrell from the University of Rochester's River Campus Library's Rare Books Department. Rare Books Special Collections and Preservation, now in possession of nearly 100 letters written between 1880 and the turn of the century by Susan B. Anthony to Rachel Foster Avery, a younger woman who was also involved in the women's rights and suffrage movement. We have on the phone with us Dr. Catherine Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership, a licensed attorney with a PhD in criminal justice and continuing to practice law. So Dr. Cerulli, familiar with Susan B. Anthony, her legacy and leadership, and certainly the modern legacy. Before we get into modern feminism, real briefly, just a quick note, and I want to hear from all of our panel on this. Every time we talk rare books and letters, I am sort of starkly reminded that my child is going to grow up in a generation, probably in a world where handwritten letters will largely be mostly gone from here forward. I mean, there isn't a whole lot of handwriting letters at all anymore. And is that going to impact our record of communication in the future? And oddly enough, could that make it even more difficult? I mean, I ask because in Susan B. Anthony's day, at least a lot of communication was kept and was sort of filed away. Now we get email and we delete it instantly. And so oddly, we've got more access to communication, but less of an impetus to keep it around. And I wonder if 100 and 200 years from now, it will be a different story. What do you think, Lori?
I guess that makes me wonder how many letters did Anthony not keep, actually?
Yeah, that's a good question.
We talk about the sort of being inundated in the digital age with information and access to information. But just as Anthony might have been selective about the letters she kept or the letters she sent, we also kind of have to be selective about the information that we keep today. And with what we were talking about earlier with how she abbreviates language, I think that that kind of deciphering and that kind of understanding won't necessarily change just because now it's typed. It's just a similar process, just a different medium.
What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, this rapidly becomes an IT question. A digital preservation question. The digital can be radically ephemeral if the servers aren't properly cared for and backed up. We know pretty well as librarians and preservationists how to store and keep track of paper and other objects like that to keep it away from fire, keep it away from heat and water, control the humidity and the temperature. And you can be pretty confident that in 100 years you could go back to the shelf, find it there, and be able to decipher it. Not so with a floppy disk, with a USB stick, or even with the contents of a spinning disk that's backed up in the cloud. So these are really important questions that relate directly to the practice of 21st century archival archivists and librarians, and we're worried.
Dr. Cerulli, when's the last time you wrote a letter by hand and put it in the mail?
Maybe a couple weeks ago. Oh, okay. Thank you note.
See, that's good. Thank you note should always be handwritten, right?
I think so. I think more about the digital age with my children's generation. I have a soon-to-be 18-year-old and a 14-year-old, and their communication with friends is instant and gone in a moment because they're doing things like Snapchat, where these little snippets of information disappear into cyberspace, you know, moments after they've been posted. And I think a lot about the preservation of how generations develop and form. In reading the letters in the New York City Library, Susan B. actually comments that Stanton had burned some of the letters that she had received from Susan B. simply probably because of a storage perspective or just a clean out. So I agree with Lori. You know, I think there were hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of letters that we'll never see. I think the beauty of purchasing a collection of letters is to be able to follow them in time and not have to jump between different people and different themes. So, yes, I think you raised an excellent point. How are we going to be preserving history moving forward in the development of generations and the way that they think about social justice and activism?
And to Jim's point there, I think it was a very wise decision to pursue the entire collection for exactly the reason Dr. Cerulli just said. Just wonderful that the University of Rochester was able to obtain all of those nearly 100 letters. Now, Dr. Cerulli, last week on the program we talked about a movement that is started online in January. called Women Against Feminism, and it's this notion of women holding up signs that say, I don't need feminism because X, Y, Z. And we talked about what modern feminism means. And first of all, I'd like your reaction to that kind of a theme, and I wonder if there's any way to know what a Susan B. Anthony would think about, I don't need feminism because...
Well, that's a two-part question.
Yeah, it certainly is.
We have just at the University of Rochester at our center conducted focus groups with people 18 to 90, men and women from all different walks of life, to basically ask them, what does feminism mean to you today? And there was this belief, and I believe a myth, that young women today don't see themselves as feminists. And in the both male and female focus groups with youth, primarily college students, they do view themselves as feminists, but they use different words. They talk about things like ecofeminism or human rights campaigns or campaigning for equal access to medical care. They believe that the issues of women in some ways have become siloed, that there is great activism on behalf of youth today. The word feminism, you know, is being reclaimed by many to bring back thoughts about accessibility, equality. I think that I can never speak for Susan B. Anthony, but I think that, you know, based on the letters that I've been reading and the works that have been written about her and those who knew her well, I think some of the issues, frankly, haven't changed a whole lot. I think that we are still dealing with poverty. We are still dealing with a lack of education for women globally. We are still dealing with access to equal pay. And even if equal pay is achieved, we still don't have necessarily equal benefits or equal negotiation in entering the workplace or equal access to recreational time. And we know through recreation, people build networks. And one of the issues that was very interesting in the letters that's very, very important today is this issue of the sandwich generation. In women professionals or stay-at-home moms who are caring for multiple generations at the same time as government resources shrink, family strengths need to be pulled together. So in some ways, I see the issues as becoming more globalized and in some ways more siloed, but nonetheless, I think many of the issues around social justice related to women are still on the table.
Yeah, on Twitter, Ron writes, how sad that young women think they don't need feminism shows disrespect to Susan B. Anthony and her colleagues. Would you agree with that, Dr. Cerulli?
I don't necessarily think that the young women who are thinking they don't need feminism have a good sense, perhaps, of the women's history movement or what feminism even necessarily means. It's for those women, it may have a very personal meaning. When we talk to young women today, especially on college campuses, you know, they are in a society where many of them were raised in households where both people worked. There was a sharing of household duties. Their second parent was very involved in the child rearing. Young people today have been raised in a culture where they view women as having access and having power. So I think that we need to do a better job of educating young people about Susan B. Anthony and the work of her colleagues and the movement, because if we can understand the contemporary nature of those issues, it would make feminism seem more important and more salient today. If you look at history books from young people, including those that we have in New York State, you know, Susan B. Anthony gets very little airspace in the history classes. So I think that we have our homework to do.
And online, Paul writes that you can't have masculinism. Why do we need feminism? And I think that, you know, the bottom line that Paul is making is that he's essentially saying men would be pilloried for speaking for masculinism, and he thinks it's inherently unfair to talk about feminism. I guess my response to that is, it's pretty easy being a guy, you know. In many ways, women have not been treated equally, and that's sort of why the need for the Susan B. Anthony's of the world arose. But what do you think, Dr. Cerulli?
I think masculinity surrounds us every day in every culture. It doesn't matter what institution you look at, you know, various religions, academic institutions, the field of law, the field of medicine. There's a masculine culture that surrounds, you know, every institution. And it's interesting because young men today, some of the men who participated in our focus spoke of themselves as feminists, and you know, they believed that at the end of the day, feminism, promoting equality for all and having healthy, educated, and happy women, thereby impacts child rearing and in some degrees helps them as well. So I think that some of the young men that we've been talking to through this focus group project really understand the universal nature of Susan B.'s work, that it wasn't just for women or just about women. It's about society.
And in just a minute, we've got to let Dr. Cerulli run, but let me finish with you, Dr. Cerulli, by asking, you know, occasionally you'll hear people question the feminist movement as either too hard-edged, anti-guyism, I've heard that, and things like that. That is, you know, people talk about it as if it's all in militant terms. I think when you read these letters that the University of Rochester now has, it shows you that these are strong women fighting for equality, and they also have that wonderfully human, soft, personal side. I mean, the letters from Susan B. Anthony to Rachel Foster Avery about motherhood, for example, show you that there's a much more of a diversity of sides to people than just a caricature, I guess.
I would agree with that, and I think that there's complexity to any social movement, and I think the difference is for those who stand on the outside in some ways projecting a belief gives them freedom to distance themselves. And I think if they were to view the leaders of social movements as mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, daughters, it almost becomes more difficult and more challenging for them to distance themselves and have a sense of otherness from the movement. So in some ways, putting up those walls allows for that distance to be built. But that's the goal of our Letters Project, and we're so appreciative of the University Library in helping us launch this project and be able to do it, because you know our ultimate goal is to make Susan B. come alive again and really reach out to young people and inspire them to do the work that's been left undone. And I thank you so much. I'm sorry I need to scoot a little.
No, it's no worries at all. Dr. Catherine Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, we're going to start to wrap our hour with Jim Kuhn and Laurie Burrell from the Rare Books and Special Collections at the University of Rochester, making sure that people know what is. Catherine just mentioned the Letters Project. There's the online exhibit, and then what's happening going forward. So, Jim, let's sort of go back to that and make sure people know where they can start to access a lot of these things and what's currently in place and what's coming.
Sure. So thanks. We've got an online exhibit that accompanied a physical exhibit some years ago celebrating the 1972 acquisition of the Anthony Avery collection, as well as some of the other Anthony collections at the University of Rochester. And so an online exhibit currently exists called Susan B. Anthony Celebrating a Heroic Life, which reproduces a number of letters to and from Susan B. Anthony, along with other artifacts from the collection. So folks can go online now to review those letters through digital images plus transcriptions. And we will be working in the coming weeks to digitize transcribe the new acquisitions, the new accruals to this Anthony Avery collection. I look forward to making that available online as well.
And we'll put some links up, and if you want to jump on my Twitter page, we'll do that as well and make sure that we keep you apprised of these developments so you can check them out. Because, Laurie, we've talked this hour about the notion of finding out about something but actually then seeing it in person. What are some of the reactions you get when people actually see some of these artifacts, these rare letters in person?
It sort of runs the gamut. You know, I've had students and other researchers talk about that it's life-changing, and we heard Dr. Cerulli talk about that. Other people have described it as an awesome experience. I've actually seen people cry in the library looking at these or other manuscripts that are in the collection. And it's such a personal experience. It's such a just really remarkable opportunity to be able to hold those letters in your hand or read those words. And it's just really incredible.
Is it emotional for you, or do you sort of get desensitized to it over time?
You know, sometimes I haven't been at this that long, actually, but sometimes I think that I'm getting desensitized, and then we get an incredible acquisition like this that comes in. And I was reading some of the letters the other day, and it got me. It got me again. And sometimes I think, you know, I know a lot about Susan B. Anthony, but I'm always interested in learning more, and these letters just they get you.
So outside of thank you cards, when's the last time you wrote a personal letter, Lori?
Well, if it's outside of thank you notes, it's probably a grocery list, but I'd have to really think about that.
Isn't that amazing? What about you, Jim?
Condolence cards.
So interestingly enough, when we're writing personal notes now, it's typically condolence or thank you cards. We just don't communicate by hand anymore. I guess that's the world we live in. But I think about my 2.5-year-old. I want to find him a pen pal. I want to make him to do that and feel the visceral experience of opening a letter that's come from another continent or another state. Is there value there to do that, Jim?
I have to say I do send my own nieces postcards, and they love it.
it's different than opening an email.
Children don't receive nearly enough postcards in this world.
Am I being too nostalgic, Lori?
No, I don't think so. I agree that my husband and I always joke that you have to send letters to get letters in the mail, and
That is true.
I always, run out to the mailbox, and I'm eager to see what's in there. And so I think Jim's right that we just don't do enough of that anymore.
So it's 94 years since the women's suffrage movement achieved the 19th Amendment, and we're talking about the letters that were uncovered and came to the University of Rochester's collection now, that Jim and Lori are so much a part of, that you'll have a chance to see more of as they do more work on them. What's the most difficult part of this process? What's the most painstaking part, Lori?
I think making sure that we have an accurate representation of what's in the letters is a real challenge. So as we create lists of what the letters contain or just extracting information from them, making sure that we're not making intellectual leaps ourselves.
That's an important point, because there's what the letters actually say, the actual words, making sure that you've got the handwriting down. And then there's, do you annotate it, footnote it, make sure that people understand the meaning of or the context?
And that's really where someone like Dr. Kate Cerulli comes in, because that's the work that she's doing. She's going to help us put them in context, and that's just at the very heart of the work we do in special collections to facilitate the research that researchers do.
Jim, what do you think? Hardest part for you?
The description about the letters is a really important piece. Lori's right about that. Ensuring that they're preserved in perpetuity. Just bringing the collection back here, just about in its entirety, was the critical first step that ensures that they will be accessible to future students and scholars.
But for how long? What does oxygen do, for example? How do you store letters?
Well, when Rushree's Library had its 1969 wraparound added, and Rare Books and Special Collections moved into that space, it was a state-of-the-art Class A preservation environment. At this point in 2014, we have some updating to do. We recently had the Rushree's revitalization project with architectural plans drawn up for revitalization of the library from the lower levels to the tower. And so that includes an updated preservation environment for the Rare Books and Special Collections area.
And Jim, let me kind of wrap up by asking you if you think that the current atmosphere, the current environment of acquiring letters and sometimes I use the word artifacts, I don't know if that's the right term, but items like this, historical items, if it's a healthy one. And I ask that because in this case, you end up with 90 to 100 letters, some photographs, a few other things, from a collection of a descendant of Rachel Foster Avery, right? I guess we're not exactly sure the family lineage, but it's it's a descendant, someone in the family. So some of these items get passed down. And the more they get passed down and the more generations follow, there's probably naturally a little bit of a loss of appreciation. And sometimes there's this urge to say, hey, the Antiques Roadshowism of America, what can I sell them for, even if they're in your own family? And some people might find that a little, vulgar is an extreme term. But others may say, look, at least if they end up in your hands better than anybody else, I'd rather have Jim and Lori end up with these because the preservation is important. What's your take on it?
So it's a really interesting time among collectors. There are a lot of book collectors and manuscript collectors who are divesting through sales, through in-kind donations to institutions like ours. And those are really important ways for institutions like the University of Rochester to build its collections through in-kind donations of that sort. In this case, I think we really have to recognize and honor the work that went into saving these letters from generation to generation. It's really critical that they do end up in institutions. Not everything survives from generation to generation the way these did in a family setting. And what lasts more than about a century, 90 years to a century, it's institutions. And what can provide access to future generations of students and scholars, it's libraries. So I'm certainly an advocate for making sure that material like this makes its way into institutional collections, and book dealers and auction houses are an important part of that, but so are the urge to donate and the urge to make sure that you have helped and ensure a legacy
that's
passed on to the future.
Because in this case, you had to pay for them, and you did. But sometimes they're donated. Okay, so we're getting kind of a picture of the landscape. Well, great work on this. Thank you so much, Jim and Lori. Fascinating stuff, wonderfully timely. Mm-hmm. And you've given us such an interesting look at Susan B. Anthony, at Rachel Foster Avery, at the movement that was happening at the time. And as we think about women's suffrage, it couldn't have been better times. So thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Short break, and the next hour we're talking about New York State's medical marijuana laws. Stay with us on Connections.